if you lived in a perfect world, what would reforms look like?
Well, if I were queen for a day, I would certainly look at the issue of plans taking patient assistance. So copay cards are a very hot topic, and certainly plans may not like them because they incentivize patients to and allow patients to reach their maximum out of pocket much more quickly. And certainly I'm not sure that I 100% agree with that in a better world. I do think in a world where plans are getting really significant rebates, say in the example of a drug being discounted to $69 for the plan cost, where the patient is paying $400, that becomes a very reasonable solution because the patient is paying so much more than the plan. And you know, if it is a very expensive medication and they've gone through prior authorization, I really see that as a leveling of the playing field. So first up, let's make sure patients have access to their copay assistance. And next up, I've already stated, I really feel that eliminating discounts, rebates, fees, all of these generally post-sale concessions would start to give us a much better sense of what the market really is in the United States. And I think I would be hesitant to go further than that because I don't know what that would look like 100%. And until I do, I don't want to say, you know, capping out of pocket at 10%, like, because at 10% of a very large number and an inflated number is still 10% of a large inflated number. If we can get that down to a reasonable price that, you know, say is closer to price in Great Britain, where they can buy a GLP-1 for $100 per month, where people here are paying closer to $1,000, that starts to feel like a win for both employers' plans and for the employee. Now, that may be a different situation in the fully funded world where plans are making a lot of money and maybe premiums go up because they're not able to make as much money on the drug cost. For example, I saw one plan in Minnesota that made $12 million on their rebates. So that's where I say it becomes so complicated to fully understand when you push a lever what the outcomes are actually going to be. So I tend to be very conservative when it comes to starting to say this is my policy wish list. I think transparency into what people are paying, how much is actually being paid, where and when, starts to be a very reasonable first step.
There was an analogy that you used to help people better understand kind of what's happening with rebates and copay cards. Can you help us share that example?
Yeah, so I've used the Menards rebate example, right, where it's 11% off, you feel like it's so great, but then you realize everything is already like inflated by at least 11%, so like you're not actually coming out ahead. The other example that I like to use is spending money on a credit card so that you can get points to have a free vacation, and yet you're still spending maybe more money than you anticipated on your credit card so that you reach this free vacation standpoint, and maybe you end up with more debt on a credit card because you didn't go and find like the really super low deal on a vacation and, you know, search that out and find it and pay that cost up front. Instead, you felt like getting something for free was a really great deal, or, you know, felt really good. And so you just continue to pay when maybe savvier shopping mechanism would have just been to say, all right, I'm going to go on all of these discount rebate, you know, websites and see what I can find, you know, maybe go on Kayak, Explore, and discover that instead of needing to pay $10,000 to get $200 in flights, you could just pay maybe $100 as a discount, so, or flat right out of your pocket.
I want to address this idea that specialty medications could potentially not be covered under certain self-funded plans.
Yeah, so that's already happening in a couple of different ways. The first was really the rise of alternative funding programs, and that's where you have a very clever shop set up and say, you know what, and I've actually heard this pitch, you know what, most copay assistance programs, or most pharmaceutical companies have a foundation that will give free drug to most Americans. You know, the cutoffs are pretty generous because there are people who don't have insurance who make good money. And so I'll tell you what, employer, why don't you just stop covering these specialty medications, pay us a fee, and we'll go out to these patient assistance programs, we'll submit the application, and we'll get your people the drug. Well, understandably, pharmaceutical manufacturers were pretty upset by that, and they've really started to restrict. So now what we're seeing is the rise of importation. So they'll go to the patient assistance fund first. If that doesn't happen, then they'll go to an international pharmacy and import, which is legally interesting, shall we say. So, and then the other piece is Kevin, who may or may not appear later on, his plan got hit, according to their pharmacy benefit manager, PBM, with a lot of high-cost pharmacy claims a few years ago. And so they've put in place really, really strict and stringent pieces. And so they are starting to, for example, he is on a dual medication. He has one that is an infused drug, and then he has an oral. It will, in theory, cure his leukemia in several months. And his plan is not paying for one of those medications. And the really sad part of that is that he applied to the pharmaceutical manufacturer. They believed that they had one of these alternative funding programs in place. They did not. And so they denied his patient assistance fund. And I believe that's going to become more and more common as pharmaceutical companies tighten and fewer employers cover these medications. One thing I do want to just raise is that specialty medications is a payment term. So often, back in the day, you would have medications that required maybe more handling, maybe they required refrigeration or whatnot. So pharmacy benefit managers and, you know, decided to call these specialty medications. Maybe they managed a complex condition or whatnot, but it was a way for them to charge more money for the services that they were providing. And so we've actually even seen an increase in specialty generic medications, which is kind of an oxymoron, because the American compact of how we pay for medications is that Americans a while ago decided that they were willing to pay higher prices for immediate access to medication and to not wait for the generic to come out, which many countries do. And in exchange for that, when the generic did come, it would be very, very inexpensive. But then you start to see these medications, these cheap medications like the $9 example, be translated into a specialty medication that then inflates the cost by essentially 150%. And so what, from a regulatory and drug development standpoint, you have our a new drug application, which for most people you understand to be a drug, a branded drug. So like it has a special name and it's only made by one manufacturer. And then you have a generic that doesn't have a particular name. It's known by the molecule and it's also potentially made by many. And so, you know, competition comes in, the price gets a little lower. And so this concept of specialty has become very, very fuzzy, particularly as it really only pertains to payment and reimbursement.
Got it. And talking about, you know, generics and patents, that was something that Bill brought up. Because some of his and Cole's asthma medication, just before the patent is about to expire, they'll change one small thing, basically start a new patent, and it won't, the generic won't be.
Yeah, it won't be allowed. And I think, you know, if we go back to my regulatory wish list, I do think limiting patent extensions to actual molecule changes, so changes within the actual medication itself, potentially dosing, although that gets really complicated because sometimes manufacturers, and there's a great example in the cancer space, I'm blanking on it, will like increase the dose like to the maximum tolerability for patients, even though it's not the minimum effective dose. And so sometimes they'll start, and I was actually on a medication, it was called Copaxone, it's still available, but they had me injecting every day. And I think now it's gone down to 3 times a week. And so I do not want to incentivize a higher dose, because certainly that can be very, very problematic because it increases side effects and, you know, potential negative consequences. You know, the packaging things can change. So like if you go to a self-injection syringe versus just a, you know, manual syringe, that can potentially extend a patent. So I think like those pieces are, we're not incentivizing manufacturers to come up with their, you know, best and final sort of immediately. It's sort of the slow process of attrition. And, you know, Humira is a great example. I think it had, I think, 2 or 3 times the amount of patent life that it maybe should have. And so I do think addressing how we patent medications, and I mean, there may be reasons to offer certain medications a longer patent if the price is decreased. So for example, cell and gene therapies. I'm not sure we're ever going to see generic cell and gene therapies because it's an incredibly complex process and it requires a lot of startup and continuous manufacturing. So for potentially rare diseases or other medications that we're not going to see that price competition, potentially offering reasonable terms. Now reasonable is obviously in the eye of the beholder, that could drop the cost initially so that we don't see these potentially 3 million price tags to facilitate access. I think that's a very interesting proposition, but I think for the medications that we've had be approved, which are, you know, the goal to have a huge blockbuster that's going to have all of these indications and, you know, continue to pursue these, you know, indications, that starts to feel very uncomfortable because it's breaking the compact that we as Americans agreed to, which was to pay higher prices for a branded medication while it's under a patent. Like, and I think we mostly think of a patent as that initial set term, not these, you know, continuous renewals, and then we get a generic that is much cheaper.
Mm-hmm. And then can you talk about what went wrong with Cole's case?
So I'm not an expert on Cole's case, but my understanding is there was a change of benefit plan, And so when people change benefit plans, in theory, welfare benefits managers, so these employers, should be providing everyone with 60 days notice when things are removed from the plan. That's a federal statute. The state statute is also to provide notice, but the ERISA plans are regulated at the federal level. And so they require, ERISA requires 60 days notice of changes. I am not sure that anyone got that in this particular case. So when he went to refill his medication, like many people, after office hours, accessing a pharmacy because it's convenient and accessible, he was told his medication was not on formulary and that he would be responsible for the total cost. And when he requested a generic, there wasn't one available or he couldn't access it at a reasonable cost. So he went home without it and had a deathly asthma attack only a few days later. And I think this really highlights the fact that patients can do everything right. They can request the generic. They can try and find lower cost opportunities if they're in a position where they can't call their doctor because they're working and they expect to go and fill it up. They're going to walk out of a pharmacy without that medication. And then getting a hold, and I always like to say that if I have to go to a specialist in a facility in one of these large health systems, it's going to take, I mean, they say 24 hours for an initial response. Mm-hmm. And then it's probably going to take a little bit longer, you know, to look at the formulary. So you're probably talking 2 to 3 days in order to get a medication issue sorted. Maybe I'm being too long, but I'll just say, in my experience, it usually takes 2 to 3 days to get any sort of answer. And it's not because hospitals don't want to do a good job. It's just there's a lot of those messages. And so I get very concerned when I hear stories like this, that, you know, the expectation is always that patients should ask for the lowest medication, like lowest cost medication. That's what we expect them to do. And yet formulas and all of this are sometimes created to incentivize the use of the highest cost medication to maximize post-sale, you know, concessions like rebates or fees.
How difficult is it for patients and employers who are operating self-funded plans, and maybe they're not this massive company with their own people on staff?
Yeah.
How difficult is it to know what is right and what decisions to make?
Well, I would say even the large companies who have a lot of staff still rely on brokers or advisors. And brokers, one of the things that the Consolidated Appropriations Act identified and now requires is a thing called a compensation disclosure. And that means that your broker needs to disclose where all of their compensation is coming from. Because what we sometimes see is certain brokers receiving compensation from, say, the pharmacy benefit manager that they recommend. And so I think in any other situation, I mean, think about it sort of as an agent who's representing both the buyer and the seller. And, you know, certainly you might wonder, am I getting the best deal as either in that situation because they're receiving compensation from both? And so I think that's a really good analogy for brokers who are receiving compensation both from the plan itself to retain their services and give them good advice, and potentially from the PBMs or the health plans or really whatever that they're recommending you use. And then sometimes there's even sort of back-end compensation where a broker might get a dollar per script. So if you've got a really big plan, that's very, very attractive, right? That's that's potentially a lot of money that's going. But when, I mean, it's economics 101, that money just doesn't appear out of nowhere. That is packed into what employers and patients are paying for their medications and all of that. So it just increases cost.
What do you think is most important for people to understand about everything we're discussing?
That if you think you understand it, add six more steps, six more people who are trying to make money off of one medication that maybe only has three true steps to pass from a manufacturer to a to a location and then go to a pharmacy that gives it to a patient. Whereas I think there's probably up to 12 administrative steps for that same medication to get to a patient. So there's that. I also think understanding that mostly whatever price you think you're paying is a made-up number. And for patients, they're paying based on a list price that nobody else pays.
And how should patients understand what to do and how to pick a good plan or know what's in their plan, or do they have any choice? I mean, are we a little bit hopeless?
I think it depends. I think right now it's a really difficult time. I don't want to sugarcoat that for anyone. Right now, if your employer meets that minimum value standard of 60%, you can't go onto the marketplace and get subsidies. So if they've chosen to laser out or otherwise eliminate access to a drug that maybe keeps you whole and working, the one option is to look at the marketplace, because the marketplace does require coverage of at least one medication in a class. So you could potentially not be on the exact medication, but be on something in the same class, which may or may not work as well. But you're going to be paying 100% of the undiscounted premium. And, you know, certainly asking your employer if you're in the situation where they make plan changes, you know, what they are, and asking for that 60 days notice. So maybe you can prepare. And I do think, you know, trying to find alternatives. I think Mark Cuban is a great one, because I do think, again, if we're paying so much for even just generics, if we start to bend that cost curve in these areas that are easy, we might not just realize savings, but opportunities to realign benefits with the interest of the patient. I also think for self-funded plans, looking at the rebates that they're getting and potentially assigning those more to patients or sharing the savings starts to potentially be reasonable. I think it's very difficult for self-funded plans to know that they're getting 100% of those post-sale concessions, so it's very likely that those numbers are still inflated for them.
You said Mark Cuban?
Mark Cuban.
Mark Cuban?
Yeah.
What is that?
So there's several of these popping up. So there's the Mark Cuban, there's an Amazon pharmacy, and then there's some just sort of national mail order. And what they do, and there's even, you know, point of sale sites. Essentially, what pharmacists have started doing is creating a cash-only business. So they will give you the cash price that is potentially much significantly lower than you're paying on your plan. And, you know, so there is the potentiality for you to get really significantly discounted medications. I get most of my medications through my primary care.